Okay, so we'll begin with each of our guests saying a few words about this topic, and then we'll have a more general discussion. So we'll start with Martin.
Good evening. Thanks very much for coming. I praise you when you come in foul weather, and I also praise you when you come in fine, because you could be languidly watching Andrew Murray getting beaten by Andy Roddick. we're about to embark on a discussion of the most somber subject there is, so I thought I'd begin with a joke at the expense of my dear colleague John McAuliffe, who is sitting with my wife there in the fourth row. He's a passionate, visceral, neurotic, and I may say rather jelly-kneed supporter of Arsenal football team. And when Arsenal were not only thrashed but totally exposed and denuded by Manchester United in the Champions League semi-final, I looked at the first headline I saw the next morning was Arsenal fan commits suicide. So, of course, I got straight on the phone to Nancy McAuliffe to commiserate with her, but it seemed that John had narrowly survived. I'd like to say some things about my guests, our guest tonight. I've known Melvin since the early 70s, when we met, I think, when I was one of his guests on Read All About It, to the tune of Paperback Writer. Incidentally, when Paul McCartney was 64, he gave an interview in the New Yorker where he said that Paperback Writer was based on me, the idea. And I wept with joy and gratitude. But in fact, I was 17, I think, when the song came out, so it couldn't have been me. Now, Melvin, he was a serious and remarkably versatile novelist, as well as all the other things he does, puts one in mind of or contra Auden, who said, Auden said that there are perhaps not many novelists and poets who wish that they were the only novelist or poet that's ever been. But he said, but nearly all of them wish that they were the only one alive at the time. This is perfectly true, I think. And it is very rare indeed for a serious novelist to have such an appetite for celebration as Melvin has. And there's hardly, not only hardly a writer, but hardly an artist on these islands who doesn't owe a great deal to Melvin. Extraordinarily generous mind he has, while being serious and remarkably versatile novelist himself. Al Alvarez I've known for even longer, since I was a baby, in fact. And I remember one day in the countryside of Cambridgeshire, when I was 13, Al showed up for the day. He was a friend of my father then, before they broke up over Vietnam. And when Al came, it wasn't like the usual friend of parents, because he took me out for the afternoon. We roared around the country lanes in his souped-up VW and climbed haystacks and had adventures. And not many of my parents' friends did that kind of thing. As well as writing the great classic, The Savage God, many other books, the two books I want to pair is that Al is the author of, I take it was your thesis, The School of Donne.
Yeah.
About the metaphysical poets, and then much later, The Biggest Game in Town, about Las Vegas and the World Poker Championship. And I thought not many men or women could write a book about the school of John Donne, George Herbert, and Andrew Marvel, and also write a book about the school of Doyle Brunson, Byron Cowboy Walford, and crazy Mike Caro. As Al reminds us in his book, Wittgenstein said that suicide is the elemental crime. It's like no other. And I just like to ask, I mean, you're a youngish audience as far as I can tell, but how many of you have how many of your lives have been touched by suicide? Hands up if suicide has touched your life. Quite a few, and believe me, you won't get through life without it touching you. The mother of my oldest child committed suicide, and I never lived with her, and it was an affair. But when it's that close, you're left with a weird feeling, and I think often of the Peter Porter's lines in his poem An Exequy, where his wife committed suicide, and he wrote this poem which echoes The Exequy by Thomas King, I believe. Anyway, it has the lines, "I owe a death to you. One day the time will come for me to pay, when your slim shape from photographs stands at my door and gently asks if I have any work to do or will I come to bed with you." Now, that moment describes what must have happened hundreds of times in their life, that she went to bed early, Peter stayed up to work. But in this context, "if I have any work to do or will I come to bed with you, I owe a death to you." That means, will you join me in the bed of death? Peter did have work to do, and he's still very much alive, as they say. But Sylvia Plath had work to do, so that's not it. And as a subject, suicide is perhaps uniquely slippery. I wrote a novel about suicide, so I read Al's book and many others, and certain things emerge in all cultures. This is from the novel Night Train. Risk of suicide increases with age. People think it's a romantic, you know, adolescent thing. No. Increases with age, but not steadily. The diagonal graph line seems to have a flattish middle section, like a flight of stairs with a landing. Statistically, for what stats are worth, if you make it into your 20s, you're on level ground until the risk bump of the midlife. About 50% of suicides have tried before. They are parasuicides or pseudo-suicides. About 75% give warning. About 90% have histories of egression, histories of escape. Suicide is very means dependent. Take the means away, toxic domestic gas, for instance, and the rate plummets. Here is 70% leave suicide notes, some say, others say 30%. And this is why the subject is so hazy, because suicide notes are often sort of, you know, snaffled up by the family. It may run in families, but it's not inherited. I remember Kurt Vonnegut saying to me in an interview, his mother committed suicide, and he said, it gives you this new alternative when things go wrong. He said, at the farm, his house in the country, if the pump doesn't work, I say, fine, I'll kill myself. If the roof leaks, he says, great, I'll blow my brains out. It makes it a possibility in the way that it isn't. But it's not inherited. It is a pattern or a configuration. It's not a predisposition. If your mother kills yourself, it won't help, and it opens a door. Here are some other do's and don'ts, or don'ts, anyway. Don't work around death. Don't work around pharmaceuticals. The professions most likely to bulk up the suicide rate are things like vets, pharmacists, doctors, dentists, people who witness human decay as part of their jobs, but also have access to the means of ending it. Don't work around death. Don't be an immigrant. Don't be a German just off the boat. I once saw a heartbreaking map about the settlement of America seen in terms of suicide. And it was quite spotty on the East Coast, with all these European settlers flooding across the American plain. And then the suicide rate thickens up all the way towards the West, suggesting that nostalgia, which literally means return home pain, is a powerful agent in suicide. Don't be Romanian. Don't be Japanese. Don't live where the sun doesn't shine. Don't be an adolescent homosexual. One in three will attempt. Don't be a nonagenarian Los Angelian. Don't be an alcoholic. Don't be schizophrenic. Disobey those voices in your head. Don't be depressed. If we can get an inch further on this subject, then we will have achieved quite a lot, because it's horribly mysterious and also strangely grave as a crime. Chesterton said that suicide was a heavier undertaking than murder. The murderer kills just one person. The suicide kills everybody. And this is from Nabokov, The Eye. So, the young man has been humiliated and thrashed in public, and he's decided to shoot himself. I saw now how conventional were my former ideas on pre-suicidal preoccupations. A man who has decided upon self-destruction is far removed from mundane affairs, and to sit down and write his will would be, at that moment, an act just as absurd as winding up one's watch, since together with the man, the whole world is destroyed. The last letter is instantly reduced to dust, and with it all the postmen, and like smoke vanishes the estate bequeathed to a non-existent progeny. All the postmen, that is genius. I resist Chesterton's formulation. I think Nabokov is moral but not moralistic and more persuasive. Somehow suicide escapes morality. Throughout history, suicide has been arduously detaching itself from human censure, the curses and penalties, the rock-heaped graves in unsanctified ground, the defiled cadavers. Why drive a stake through their hearts when, as James Joyce knew, their hearts have been broken already? In that novel, Night Train, I have my female policewoman say, "It used to be said not so long ago that every suicide gave Satan special pleasure. I don't think that's true, unless it isn't true either, that the devil is a gentleman." But the devil is not a gentleman. And the kind and the good do come to grief. And when Satan in Paradise Lost sets up from Pandemonium, abode of all demons, this was his mission: to waste his God's whole creation, to confound the race of mankind in one root, and earth with hell to mingle and involve. Suicides, too, are world killers. They are, in that critical moment, every man and every woman. But no blame attaches. I think suicide, I'll read one more thing from Nabokov. I think suicide is like a bad marriage with life. You're married to life, and it's unhappy. And as with a bad marriage, you stay and you stay and you stay, and then you can't stay, and then you leave. And for the suicide, you stay and you stay until you can't stay, but where do you go to? I'm going to read just a paragraph from an absolutely sensational short story called Signs and Symbols by Nabokov, 6 or 7 pages long, about a madman who does commit suicide. And it's seen through the viewpoint of his parents. It also contains another single sentence flash of genius, which is about the Holocaust. Not our subject tonight, but I'll just give you an idea of this sentence, and I'm getting keener and keener on sentences that reveal genius. He describes a rather wild-eyed old lady who lived in Germany, Leipzig, Aunt Rosa, fussy, angular, wild-eyed old lady, and whose life was completely given over to fretting about her family and her collateral family. Bad news, bankruptcies, train accidents, cancerous growths, quote, until the Germans put her to death, together with all the people she had worried about. As if, you know, that sorts all that out. You know. Anyway, this old couple have a son in a lunatic asylum who is suffering from referential mania. He imagines that everything happened around him is a veiled reference to his personality and existence. Now, he's already tried to kill himself once by jumping. It's another sort of terrible Nabokovian joke, by jumping from the top floor of the lunatic asylum until an envious patient, fellow patient, stopped him because he thought he was about to start flying. Now, Al has a very good shot at describing the coiled world of suicide, as he puts it, where everything seems to point towards you in this unhappy marriage with life. And Nabokov gives us the mind of this maniac who is insane. And all this allows Nabokov to do is to turn up the dial on this sort of feeling where you think everything's against you. And this is what results. Phenomenal nature shadows him wherever he goes. Clouds in the staring sky transmit to one another by means of slow signs incredibly detailed information regarding him. His inmost thoughts are discussed at nightfall in manual alphabet by darkly gesticulating trees. Pebbles or stains or sunflecks form patterns representing in some awful way messages which he must intercept. Everything is a cipher, and of everything he is the theme. Some of the spies are detached observers, such as glass surfaces and still pools. Others, such as coats in store windows, are prejudiced witnesses, lynchers at heart. Others, again, running water, storms, are hysterical to the point of insanity, have a distorted opinion of him and grotesquely misinterpret his actions. He must be always on his guard and devote every minute, module of life, to the decoding of the undulation of things. The very air he exhales is indexed and filed away. If the only interest he provokes were limited to his immediate surroundings, but alas, it is not. With distance, the torrents of wild scandal increase in volume and volubility. The silhouettes of his blood corpuscles, magnified a million times, flit over vast plains, and still farther, great mountains of unbearable solidity and height sum up in terms of granite and groaning firs the ultimate truth of his being. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Martin.
Melvin.
Melvin, are you going next?
Yes, well, good evening, and thank you very much for turning up. I'll concentrate on a specific, which is this novel that you referred to. Martin's brought in a great number of sources and talk more generally, and we haven't consulted, but I expect Al will cover a range, as he does indeed in his book. But I want to talk about Remember Me for a few minutes, and the experience of writing about the subject that we're talking about. Suicide. Remember Me, as was said, began with a novel called The Soldier's Return, which was set in 1946. And it's important for me to go back there just for one moment, because it started with a death. And Remember Me ends with a death. The first word of Remember Me is remember. And the last word in the book is memory. And the death is inside that remembering, a death, which the writer does, the death of his wife. And the decision I made then coloured the subsequent books, and it's important to say that, for me to say that, because there was a perfectly fair interview, and very generous interview, by Peter Kemp in the Sunday Times when the book came out, which stressed the autobiographical side quite legitimately. But for a while it became taken up as an autobiography and not what it is, which is autobiographical fiction. So I want to say something about that for a moment. When my father died, I wanted to write about him. All I'd seen of him in the war, I was born in 39, all I'd seen of him, he went away in the war, were little smudges. And there were smudges. They were there, they were something, but they were just little smudges, like splashes of paint. Then I left home when I was 17 or 18, 300 miles away, didn't see much of him and so on. But when he died, I knew I wanted to write something about him. And to cut to the chase, my memory was so bad in terms of any sense of accuracy or resonance anything that mattered when it came to writing. And some people can write memoirs, and I just couldn't do it for a moment. I wouldn't be able to bring real people into play for fear of offending them, or for fear of not getting it right, or for fear of missing them out, or for fear of getting something wrong. I would just bump into all the furniture, and I couldn't make it work. Nor did I really want to, so I decided to write it as fiction. Now, I followed closely the life of that particular reunion in 1946, novel lasted only over 6 or 9 months, and I carried that through to another one, Crossing the Lines, Son of War, about the impact of war, and the war between the parents on this boy, and then Crossing the Lines, the boy who's out, still using a fairly military reference to out of this little northwest England, even further north than you, fortress of a little old town, a rough town, a very poor town, into university, and so on. And then we came to Remember Me. Now, I've written about autobiographical fiction at a reasonable length, but to get there, it seems to me that this is what happens. It's like Darwin's finches. You've got, and one of the things that astounded Darwin about the Galapagos, as you know, is that he could see evolution taking place. This staggered him. His theory was, building up his theory, was accretion over millions and millions of years, slow accretions. He saw it happening. On that island there was a finch. There's a gap, and that next island, the finch had changed. And that finch had changed again, and it was a different sort of finch there. And finally, on that island, it had turned into another bird that couldn't even mate with that. And that's what happens in autobiographical fiction, in my experience. You start with yourself and your father and your mother's material, and then in the process of writing fiction, which is what I do, it changes into a completely different bird. And that's the best I can put it. And that's important, because it allows you, it liberates you in ways that I don't think, not for me, memoirs could. For instance, in that first book, I wanted the father, the mother, and the son to have an equal stake in the book. He'd been away in Burma in a savage war. She'd had to make a life of her own to earn money, usually cleaning houses. And this little boy had been brought up by her, slept in the same bed as her for all his early life, and so on and so forth. I wanted the sort of rages of the three to be expressed as strongly as I could inside the language and convention of that particular decade. But I couldn't have done that, thinking about my father and mother and myself as a child. I wouldn't have got anywhere. I wouldn't have dared do it. But in fiction, I could go there. And so we came through to Remember Me. And I, as it were, started to think about writing it. I would take this novel through the 60s. And I realised what was going to happen at the end of it. So, was that my wife's going to take her own life? Or the person who started as my wife is going to take her own life? So first of all, I talked to our daughter. And made her a promise, which I repeat inside the book, or the writer, Joseph Richard, repeats inside the book, that if she objected to anything at all, I wouldn't publish it. And she knows that I meant it. Well, of course I meant it. And but I wanted to write it. I didn't particularly want to publish it. And a lot of times, I wish I hadn't published it. But I wanted to write it. It had come around. I didn't intend to write it. I didn't plan to write it. It just came at the end of this. There was the next book. Up it came, and I wanted to write it. So that was the agreement that we struck. And I showed it to her as it went on, and I wrote it and rewrote it. And she did object to a few things, and I took them out. It's a sort of rather sad sort of satisfaction that the things she objected to were wholly fictional. But that was okay. That really was okay. So we knew where we were. And when I finished the final version, which was about fourth or fifth, whatever it was, and she read it, what she said was, "Thank God you've done it." And she meant for me, because she'd been through all this, and I hadn't. She's a priest, well, a vicar, I suppose, but they call them priests now in the High Anglican Church. And she'd been through it. She'd seen herself through it. And I hadn't. I'd taken the other route, which you can, which is, in a sense, the way they built the spire on Salisbury Cathedral, on the swamp, they put mat after mat after mat after mat inside that swamp, just to hold the stuff down, and they built the spire on top of that. And they buried it. They buried the problem. And I think you can go a long way with burying the problem. And sometimes they're better buried, in my view. Because this has certainly disrupted me more than it's helped. It's been absolutely no therapy whatsoever. So I started to write it. And then when I was writing it, partly because I really did think I was not going to publish it. You'll have to believe me. You have to believe. Of course you believe me. Why shouldn't you? So I felt very liberated. I just thought, I'm going to push it. I'm really going to push it. Autobiographical fiction, people disguise it. So many writers write autobiographical fiction and have done, particularly in the last century. It's increasing its momentum, and they disguise it. The guy, instead of being this, is that, which is adjacent but nearly the same. And I thought, no, I'm going to, instead of making him a teacher, as it were, I'm going to television like I did. He'll do arts, for example, like I did. Just get out there and don't be frightened. If you're going to do it in every way. Just do it. And expose yourself as the writer of this book in this autobiographical fiction way. And do the same with the woman, Natasha. And also try to make it into the sort of novel that I wanted to write. I want a novel which sort of feathers off into other characters and has a social and a temporal context. And that matters a lot to me, the place, the time, the influence of place and time on character, on situation and on development. So I wanted to do all that. But the drive in it was this drive towards the suicide. And the only way I could tackle it when I started to write it eventually, you know, was to put it at the beginning. In page one, you know everything that's happened. And that's because I didn't want it to be a plot. I didn't want to play with the idea of, will it, won't it happen? Oh, my goodness, what, oh, dear. I didn't want any of that. That's the plot, yeah. People are wonderful at plots. And it's very important to have that narrative drive. And so I didn't want to do that here. It seemed to be tactless and seemed to be irresponsible, really. And there was a better way to do it. Formally, there's a better way, because a novel has two structures. It's telling the story as it happened, and it's writing a letter to the daughter, and these two intersect all the time, and she begins to comment on what's been said and what's happening. And in a sense, it's also it's her story, and it's the story of the survivor, who was the writer, called Joseph Richardson, who'd arrived in 1946, as it were, and it's the story of the person who took her own life. And I found I used the word use, and that might well be picked up and used as an accusation. But things that had really happened between Lisa and myself, although they changed utterly inside the fiction. I mean, on the merest, silliest way, it's about 450, 500 pages. But we had a life together for 11 years. And how do you shape and do that? What's important? What do you take through? What's nuanced, and I wanted to be in a sense forensic. I didn't want to leave anything the self unturned, any stone unturned if you want, and also the present, because he was writing it in the present, and there's a great deal of guilt, self laceration, and fury at himself, not enough perhaps looking back on it, enough fury at what had happened because of her, really, to be honest. So that's the way it developed. In terms of what there is to say, it seemed to me that what happened was, in this case, I am absolutely convinced that if we'd stayed together, we'd have both gone down. Or maybe all three of us. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I had an enormous crack-up. A really bad breakdown. And I couldn't go. There's all sorts of things I couldn't do. Travel on a train, all sorts of things. It was absurd. And it lasted a while, 2 or 3 years. And she was in trouble. She went into analysis. Her analyst killed herself. She didn't tell me that her analyst had killed herself. And on it went, and it was just accretion and accretion. Then I left her. I kept going back, And so what I found in writing about this is this, it is, Amartya's analogy is a good one about a marriage to life. But it seems that it's the just the oppression of the accretion of disadvantage, and it ends up as a despair, and then it seemed to me in this case it ended up as a fear of going mad, and it was an alternative to going mad. And so that was driving that through, and I didn't think of it as a forensic examination of suicide. It sort of is, really. It's certainly a forensic examination of a marriage that started off with, again, clichés are quite useful now, and then started off with very high hopes. And it was wonderful for several years. It was absolutely wonderful. Through the early years, through the early childhood. And then it, what almost would have brought you together, the differences between the two people, which were enormous, began to pull it apart and ripped it apart. So that's the contribution that I can bring at this particular time. I'm quite happy to talk about it generally as we go on. But that's why I'm here. On this, that's why Martin asked me to be here. And so that's my contribution so far. Thank you.
Well, I mean, see, the basis of my book is twofold. That I had a terrible, like Melvin and Steve, unhappy marriage, which mercifully was quite short, but it at the end, towards the end of it, I had a suicide attempt. On the other hand, I think I was kind of pretty depressed before that, and the whole subject of depression is something that if you're going to talk about suicide, you cannot get away from. Anyway, leaving that aside for the moment, that I'd have my little fling, yeah, and then my little suicidal fling, and then Sylvia Plath, whom I'd got to know, she did it, and brought it off, as it were. Although I think in all fairness that she kind of she did it in such a way as to leave all the doors open so that she could be so that she could be saved, but it was one of those kind of unlucky things where everything goes wrong. But anyway, I'd got to know Sylvia, and one of the things that well, two things kept us joined us. And that was, I was at that time doing this. I was poetry editor stroke critic for the Observer. It was all sort of acting, lots, unpaid, you know. It was the Observer hadn't quite got round to making it official. But I did it for 10 years, and it was a wonderful period when Lowell started publishing. Lowell's books came to England. Berriman's books came to England. I started editing a series for Penguin called Penguin Modern Poets in Translation, and wonderful poets like Zbigniew Herbert and Miroslav Holub and so on suddenly appeared in English. It was a kind of really live time, and at the same time, Ted Hughes was writing, beginning to write, and so this kind of meteor, which was Sylvia, you know, kind of shot, comet, you know, shot through the firmament and died out. And it was kind of very lively, interesting time. And I was right at the heart of that, I guess. I was, you know, inasmuch as nobody really reads poetry. In those days, they read it slightly more than they do now. But, you know, it is the most minuscule of ponds, you know. You know, and I was a sort of lively minnow in that minuscule puddle, which was poetry. But the thing about suicide is that it leaves, like a comet, it leaves a trail, as Melvin's just been saying. You know, it's that you, a huge backlog of guilt, also rage. I mean, as I say, one of the key things in depression is key elements of depression is rage, which gets turned on itself. You turn your outrage or your rage actually onto yourself. You can't tolerate yourself, etc., etc. You know, anyway, what happened was that I'd had this practical experience, as it were, and also this was a kind of weird time. This was mid to late 60s that I was writing the book. The book was actually published in 71, but it took 4 years to write. So it was the mid-60s when I started. And this was a kind of curious time. It was, first of all, it was the, you know, everything was kind of collapsing, you know, that all those old moralities that we'd been brought up in, or people of my generation have been brought up in, were suddenly falling. But it was, the other thing was, it was that, think of Dr. Strangelove, it was the time when we all thought, all of us, didn't matter what our thing, that some asshole, some Dr. Strangelove idiot, was going to, what, theirs or ours, was going to press the button. There was a kind of general, kind of, how do I put it, sort of universal sense of threat. You know, we could be witnessing the end of the world. You know, somebody's going to, you know, do the Strangelove thing. And so there was that, that was very much in the, a back, in the background when I started the subject. But I was interested in it anyway because my, you know, I don't know. It was also a time in which the 50s was one of the most dreary periods of English literature ever, you know, that. And that's a pretty strong shortlist. For poetry, certainly, it was a kind of dreadful period. And it seemed to be going on working on the subject that there were things you didn't talk about. And one of the things you didn't talk about was kind of the inner life. It still exists to some extent in a certain type of. It's a kind of English snobbery that you really mustn't discuss the inner world. Well, that's never been anything that kind of I believed in. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to take this subject of depression and suicide and bring it to life. And I did it by, you know, not doing one of these things. The world is full of very boring books about, among other things, suicide, yeah? Done by sociologists, done by psychoanalysts, done by psychiatrists, etc., etc. But what I felt was that I wanted to kind of really discuss the subject but I wanted to make it come alive to some extent. And I felt that the way to do it was, and I also, the only way I could possibly discuss it with any kind of authority was via literature, which is something I, at that point in my life, anyway, I knew a certain amount about. And I thought, so what I did was, I kind of put a thing about Sylvia. Nobody had written about Sylvia at that point. She wasn't sort of part of the, what is it, canon, whatever, you know. I was very much involved in making her part of the canon. But I thought she was a kind of wonderful poet. That she was one of those poets who, for all her, she was like, I tell you exactly like, it's exactly like Keats. If you, I know we've got to stop in a bit. But if you look at Keats's poems, that if Keats had died 2 years earlier, he didn't write anything in his last year of his life, he was too ill. But if Keats had died 2 years earlier, he'd have been a minor follower of Leigh Hunt, nothing. You know, all the great Keats poems are written within the space of 12 months. The same is Wilfred Owen, who would have been a minor Keatsian Georgian until the last 12 months of his life. And it's the same with Sylvia. She was perfectly competent, etc., etc., and very ambitious, etc., etc. But the real poems only came right at the end when she finally kind of went. She found her voice, you know, when her devil took her by her throat and shook her. And she was able to write as she should have been writing all along. But so what I did was, I'm going back to the book again. What I did was I thought, okay, I'll write about her, say why I think she's a genius, which was really, I promise you, back then was not the standard line on her. And then I thought the other end of the book, as they got two bookends, the other end of the book is an account of my own run-in with suicide, which was, as far as I was concerned, was pretty hairy. I think what I was trying to do was, using the language of the time, writing a kind of doing existential criticism. That is, I was trying to make the subject come alive as part of something that happens in people's lives, and had to be discussed in terms of people's lives. And so you had these two case histories, one at either end, and in the middle you had theoretical stuff, you had literary historical stuff, all sorts of stuff. And the whole thing was about this, what I call the closed world of depression, you know, that how do you get out of it? Now look, I'm sorry, we're going on. We should have stopped 30 minutes ago, I think. But so I'm going to stop now and hand it over to you guys. Yeah.
Well, I wondered if we could focus maybe particularly on the experience of writing about suicide and. Because all of you have written about suicide in various ways, so I was wondering, you know, what that's like, and whether in writing about suicide there's an effort to understand it, whether suicide is something that can be understood, or whether the writing is a kind of...
I can't see that it can't be understood if you're willing to open yourself up to what's actually involved. I mean, see, I thought Melvin's book was immensely brave to face that thing, and you know, it's a big, big subject. I happen not to be a novelist, and I've written and published three novels to prove it. But I'm very good when I've got a subject, when I can, you know, see well, I can observe people. I'm good at subjects, and but I haven't got the gift for telling stories, which a novelist has to have. That it seems to me that the story, the only story I could tell, was one that I'd observed, Sylvia, my own. Sorry, but I'm now hogging it. You.
Not at all.
Melvin, in terms of your experience of writing about this event, was it an effort to understand it, or did it involve a kind of a desire for a kind of catharsis, almost a way of moving, if not beyond, and then?
Well, without trying to sort of trying to be a talk lover, I don't think it was either. I don't think it was an effort at catharsis, and if it had that objective in any way, it certainly didn't get anywhere near it. As I said, quite the opposite. I mean, I think I'm the sort of person who does things better by burying them. And I didn't. And I don't think I examined it. I mean, Al, in his book, examines this idea in various contexts. Sylvia Plath's, his own, and various literary persons in the big middle section of the book. And I wasn't examining it.
Reporting?
Yes, I was writing a novel. Mm. The only way I could go on that journey, which was autobiography, was through fiction. I couldn't find anywhere else to do it. I couldn't have begun to do it. I couldn't have taken the liberties that I took with the characters, with their inner feelings and so on. But I was trying to find... I was trying to find a way to tell that story, the impact that life had had on him and her, and a lot of people around them, because it's not only just the two of them in the book. I was telling that story, and I think the word story, I'm afraid, does come strongly into what I was doing, more strongly in catharsis, more strongly than examination. It's telling that story, and how that story began. And it did begin, it began almost idyllically. That was one of the problems. Two people from completely different parts of any known world meeting, and a few weeks later deciding to get married and getting married while I was still an undergraduate. And it wasn't a forced marriage either. We wanted to get married, we got married. It was a sort of madness, but for years it worked. And then it went wrong in the most awful way imaginable, as Martin said at the beginning of his remarks. So I wanted to tell the story of that, and I waited 40 years to tell the story of that, and then I told that story based on that fact.
There are things in that book which seem to be very peculiar. There is the business that the wife's therapist kills herself. Well, this is a huge business. I said, what kind of goddamn therapist was she? I know there are all sorts of weird people out there on the outer edges of the psychotherapeutic world, but that's positively dangerous.
High up in the hierarchy of people who commit suicide.
That
I can believe.
That was based on a fact.
I realise that.
And we know that because the book's been written about that particular woman. There you go. The thing that I literally can't get over to this moment is why Lisa didn't tell me. Because she'd forced me to go into analysis, because this bloody woman said it won't work for you unless he also goes into analysis.
They're probably correct, actually.
Really?
It might have helped if you'd known the code each other's were talking.
I don't think anyone has been saved from suicide by psychiatry.
You don't know.
Medication, perhaps, but not psychiatry.
Well, psychiatry is. Let's get the terms right. A psychiatrist is someone who gives medicines. You're talking about a psychoanalyst or a psychotherapist.
Right.
Yeah. that, well, I think they're better than medicines, mostly, if they're any good at all. There happen to be a lot of kind of wild creatures on the edges of it, but the ones who know what they're doing,
I think that's true. Good. I mean, I didn't object to psychoanalysis. I objected to me being in psychoanalysis. I object. No, I suppose looking back, it's useful for me. I objected to being forced to do it.
No, forced. That's
and I was forced to do it. There was a gun to my head.
That whole thing about, you know, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? You know, one, but the light bulb has want to be changed. You know.
But interesting aside to that is when my daughter, as I said, she did a lot of those long silences and spiritual exercises with the Jesuits, although she's an Anglican. When she read that had happened, she was inflamed with fury because she was a spiritual teacher. And when they get tired, they pass them on to other people. Mm-hmm. You know?
Sure. Well,
a bit. And why did this woman not pass these on to another analyst and say, I'm really feeling bad. There's Dr. Samuel Bob three doors down, go to her for a while or him for a while, whatever it was. It's inconceivable. Anyway, there we go.
But I think the attraction, you know, as a fictional subject, is that this is the ultimate crisis of the self.
Yeah.
There's a funny bit of Sorbello where he's writing about Delmore Schwartz and John Berryman and all the other American poets who committed suicide. And he said America likes it when the poets commit suicide.
Sure.
Because it shows that America is such a huge butch operation that anyone with this sort of, you know, faggoty, poetic, they're going to go under. And he said it also shores up the cynicism of those who say, listen, if I weren't such a shit, bastard, shark and vulture, do you think I could get through this either? I mean, it's very interesting, the evolution of society's attitudes to suicide, how it changed. It seems to change with the literary pattern, like, the, you know, you get the metaphysical response, the Augustan response, the romantic response, where suddenly there were huge, you know, epidemics of suicide that rolled across Europe because it became a kind of, you know, like having the right cravat or something.
The
sorrows of young Werther.
Yeah.
And you know, by the way, we're living through just such an era, but with a huge difference in that, not to politicize this discussion, but something like 98% of all suicide bombing has taken place in this century. All the suicide bombing in history. And it's a cult, and it's...
Well, of course, obviously, one of the things that... You know, I wrote my book long before our present troubles started, but the early Christians were also a suicide cult. You know, they wanted to cast themselves, you know, have their throats cut, cast themselves, in order to... join in order to go to heaven, you know.
The Crusaders. Yeah. Richard, the Pope told those people who went on Crusades that they would die, if they died in the Crusade, they would be sitting on the right hand of God. And that would happen. And there's no doubt that they fought and thought in that way, a great number of them.
Yeah, and all the early fathers.
I'm quite interested in what you refer to the Augustan period and the Greek period, when we think of Socrates, of suicide being something, now it's never calm, but something just accepted inside society in quite a different way.
Well, the Romans, of course, thought it was the decent thing to do. Mm. You know,
falling on your sword.
Yeah, you just... You know, if life becomes intolerable, you fall on your sword.
Or if you become a public disgrace.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, or lose a battle.
What?
Or lose a battle.
Mm.
So I didn't.
Should we open it up to the audience for questions and comments? I think there are some microphones coming around. So if anyone has a question or comment, just raise your hand and then wait till the microphone reaches you. We have a gentleman. There's one at the back there. Go ahead.
Firstly, I wanted to say thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it. And also, you've spoken a lot about your own relationships with suicide, but I just wanted to ask about the relationship between literature and suicide, and about the... because obviously writing is a creative thing, and suicide is the antithesis, it's destruction. Is there some kind of relationship between creativity and destruction? I mean, lots of writers say that creativity, pain is the bedrock for creativity, and creativity, all creativity rests upon pain. And I wondered if you could speak about that kind of relationship between creation and destruction in writing.
Well, I think you're absolutely right when you say they're antithetical. That you know, suicide is the great destructive act, and writing is one of the great creative acts, and perhaps the most antithetical to suicide, in that, you know, what you do in every novel, autobiographical or not, you create a world. You assign life to various propositions. You create the postman. You don't kill all the postmen. You create all the postmen. And that is... It's the Freudian antithesis between the self-destructive and the creative, and these are the great forces in our psyches.
I think that there is another thing, and that is that I think in part of the 20th, part of the actual force of the 20th century art, I'd say from the modernists right up until the end of the century, really, there was a very curious sense of strain of things. Maybe it's the backwash of the two world wars or whatever, but and behind the need to experiment, which came in with the modernists. Is this thing working? There was a... I don't know, there was a feeling that you've got, in order to experiment, that what you were doing was, in order for it to be real rather than just sort of visual, you know, the poems that sort of step down the page, you know, one line in three steps, that sort of thing. It's something, you know, trivial aesthetic screwing around. But someone who really experimented, people experiment with a form because the form as it stands is not adequate to the new things they want to express. And therefore, experimentation implies, if it's serious, is going places psychologically that people haven't been before. And you experiment because the language or the whatever, you know, the language or the art form or whatever isn't there ready-made for you. You want to do something different. And otherwise, it's not experimenting, it's just fooling around, just posing. But I think this became a kind of 20th century thing, and I think the 20th century was a pretty creepy time, you know. There were sort of awful, you know, totalitarian societies, world wars, genocide. You know, it was not a good time. It was every reason to feel that things were going wrong. That. You know, so, and that gets reflected in the, you know, in personal lives.
And you're absolutely right, I think, about the reality of mutual assured destruction, what Eric Hobsbawm called the contest of nightmares, where in this Cold War, the only time you saw action was when you were asleep, basically. It was part of your subconscious and part of your dreams. And a great injection of what we could call the thanatoid, the death-centered part of the mind. But I don't. I think it's a more general process now. I think that, you know, the 19th century was a time where everyone felt progress and hope.
And it was a century of peace once Napoleon was gone. There were hardly any wars. Boer War, Crimea War. Then the start of everything bad in the modern world, the First World War. Everything bad comes from that. As has been said, the only way of avoiding the Second World War is if Germany had won the first. And now it's sort of rolling into a new kind of barbarism. But don't you feel, don't we all feel that history is speeded up? That it has a kind of helter-skelter quality. And the idea that the planet itself is going to cease to be hospitable, that the planet can run out, is a completely new notion and wouldn't have occurred to a 15th century farmer any more than it would have occurred to the dog sleeping at his feet. But it's in all our minds now. And this, as Al said, this pushes the individual, both in art and in life, to extreme states.
Except there were times when, for instance, the plagues came year after year, and people must have thought, and they wiped out, was it a third of Europe? People must have thought that the end had come, and they went around flagellating themselves, getting ready for the death that would fall on them, and it fell on a great number of them.
Yes, well maybe that's just part of being on... One of the things that's involved in having a stay on this planet is you have to feel you're doomed at some point. You know, we're all, getting old is a global process, but I mean us, all of us.
I think that what you said just then, previously, not that remark, the previous remark, was absolutely right. And I think you prove it in your book with many examples. And to go back to the question that the questioner, what might be the connection is that people are straining much more than they ever used to do to find out there some kind of whole shape, some kind of finished shape, like a traditional Victorian novel seems like a finished shape.
Yes,
they all live happily ever.
The
finished shape. And it's very difficult to find a finished shape. What is the finished shape?
You'd be writing a plot for the human race.
Yes. I mean, Martin's talked about the Earth cooling down, and that's a long-term thing. I was talking to somebody last night at the Royal Society, Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society, and he's written, and he's a very, very serious man. He doesn't play around. Yeah, Astronomer Royal, Master of Trinity College, blah, blah, blah. But he is more or less convinced, and he's very quiet, utterly, I can't emphasise enough how quiet, serious, and so on. And that it is more than likely that in the next 50 years there will be some massive destruction goes on, chemical. That is very, it's getting easier and easier and easier for clever young men and women, just needs two or three of them, to breed viruses which let out and can do all the things we used to read in science fiction or see on creepy crawly films cinema and that sort of thing.
Getting on a home kit.
Yes. And there's that going on, and so what's the end? And I think that that might be why the connection that you were talking about is so important has come to the foreground so very much, that it's just impossible to get hold of something, and the something is reality.
We're running out of time, but I think I'd like to have at least one more question from the audience.
There's one of them there.
Someone over there, chap over there. The red T-shirt. Yeah, the red T-shirt, I think that's what I was thinking.
Thank you. Something that's been you've alluded to, but perhaps hasn't come out enough, is there's the distinction, I think, in the motivation for suicide between, on the one hand, not wanting to live, and on the other hand, wanting to die. It's something that I recognise in those around me who have attempted suicide. I know it's something that social workers recognise. It's a theme that sometimes comes up in discussions on the ethics of whether suicide should be supported or whether information about it should be made available. It seems to me that there's huge potential for literary characterisation in that distinction. And so I wanted to put it to you, is it a distinction that you recognise in your own experiences? Is it something you think you've brought out in your own writing? Do you think it's been brought out in the writing of others?
I don't see any difference, do you? You're not going to be doing anything when you're dead. Unless you're powered by religious belief, I think the secular suicide, there's no distinction. Not wanting to live and wanting to die sort of cancel each other out, really, unless there's a religious motivation or a belief in the afterlife.
I think it's a completely different level of being. I think decisions like that, considerations like that, are just not there. If they were, you wouldn't be in that state. If you could make those distinctions, you wouldn't be where you are. I think it's a possession of a particular sort which brings into play things which cannot be articulated.
Why do you call it possession? What's wrong with the word depression?
Depression
itself is a very complicated thing,
yes,
which involves a great deal of anger. Nobody who's feeling good ever. Never actually. You've got to be feeling pretty. Robert Lowell once said to me that if there was a little switch on your arm that you could push, a little click when you really felt down, the whole world would have committed suicide.
But I was taking for granted, Richard, that it would come out of a very depressed state. I would just think that the final act of doing it, it becomes a drive towards the doing of the act, which doesn't allow for considerations such as was offered by the questioner.
No, I didn't actually quite.
It doesn't offer.
So you would say it's a sort of squirrel cage where you.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
I think that.
But once you know you're in the cage has got to be there first.
Well, no, I'm not sure. I think the nature of depression is that it takes over and everything, you translate everything into terms of it. It's not raining on Manchester, it's raining on me. That schmuck in the bar didn't do that because he's drunk. He did it to get at me. There's that,
Like the Nabokov thing where even nature. But isn't it's the case, isn't it, that if you're really depressed, you can't be bothered to kill yourself. You don't have the energy to do it. Look at
Sylvia. I say Sylvia, at the end, was probably, was actually psychotically depressed. I say right at the end.
But in manic depression, it's always in the manic phase that they kill themselves.
She wasn't manic depressive. I'm quite sure she wasn't a manic depressive. I'm really quite sure. But I think she was profoundly depressed, always, which is quite different. Mm. It doesn't have to be polar, as they say. Mm.
But in analysis, sometimes you can go with a neurosis and that can be stripped away to reveal a psychosis.
Sure.
And the neurosis has been good cover. It's been very useful.
The whole, we obviously, I differ from you two guys about analysis, apart from the fact I've actually married into the business. But the point about, I've had psychoanalysis, and the thing is, it's so interesting. I mean, the things.
Well,
No, the things you get up to without knowing you're getting up to them. The crap that you do in your life, for no reason at all, except that somehow or other. And it's fascinating. That I think just as a marvellously interesting topic, everybody should try it.
I obviously went in with the wrong attitude, really.
Yeah.
But we're not all as interesting as you. But you mean the quirks that we all have?
Yes, but it's all about character, what you do to stuff, what how you interpret things.
And is it any more about childhood?
Very little.
Yeah.
you know,
Freud is gone.
Freud hasn't gone. Freud was a great genius, but the archaeological attitude that everything, you know, all you've got to do is deal with the stuff that's buried. That's gone. What they do now is they deal in what's called the here and now. You know, what you're doing, what you are doing to the analyst, and the also analyst. What the analyst is doing to you.
It links up with the new idea of what memory is, doesn't it? We used to think that memory was this great still thing, this reservoir you could dig in. Now we think that it is something moving, and you're calling it up as you need it in different ways all the time.
Really?
It is a fluid matter that's going on there. There isn't this great quarry that you go and dig a bit out of every now and then. Archaeology brought that to mind.
Okay.
It's moving around all the time. That's why in analysis you're talking about why were you late, or why are you wearing a leather jacket, or moving on from that.
Except apropos memory, you know, let me tell you, after a certain age, forget it.
Well, I hate to bring this conversation to an end, but we are out of time. So first, just a couple of things to announce and tell you before we bring the evening to an end. On your chairs or tables, there are flyers for next season of readings, which will begin in September. And there'll be readings next year from, among others, M.J. Hyland, Vona Grauk, James Fenton, Michael Longley and Tom French. And tickets for these will go on sale at the beginning of September. One other event to put in your diaries, novelist Jeff Ryman, who teaches in the Centre for New Writing, is reading in the Central Library on Wednesday, the 22nd of July at 1 p.m, and that is free and unticketed. Also, look out for the Manchester Review, which is the manchesterreview.co.uk, and recordings of all these events, including tonight's event, will be available as podcasts on the website. Well, it's been a fascinating conversation. Perhaps you'd join me in thanking our three guests tonight.